Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 27 of season 8 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 classic Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Tierney Steele, aka One Steele Sister. Welcome back to the show, Tierney.
So glad to be back here with this dirt with you.
Yes, it's international dirt.
You know, and between the two of us, it's international dirt.
That's true also. Yeah, but neither country that we're in is included. So, you know, I don't know if that really counts. There's no dirt either from America or Israel there.
I would be happy to go to Italy, like, if that will help with the podcast.
Sure. At your expense, you're more than welcome to.
Ah, darn, that's the training.
I unfortunately don't have the budget for that. I don't even have the budget for myself to go to Italy, which is a lot closer than for you to get
there. There we go. Well, I will say if minute 26's, you know, motto was get these men all the therapy, minute 27's is Spielberg is good. He's very good.
Yes.
Even though not as much happens this minute.
That's true.
Oh boy.
It depends on how you want to look at it. A lot does happen here, but we'll have to wait and see. So minute 27 begins with Horvath stashing his loot and ends with bodies getting pushed back and forth by the waves. So basically, yesterday we ended things with Mellish breaking down. Not really knowing where he wants to go at this point, but basically he decides that as he's crying, the men around him are listening in, and we get a shot of Horvath, who everyone basically they're at a point at the end of the battle where each of them are pretty much deciding what they want to do. And you know, like, how do they want to deal with the fact that the battle is over? Like, what is their plan? And at this point, you know, Mellish has broken down and is crying over the Hitler Youth knife. You know, again, you can go back to yesterday's episode to try and understand the two options of what we think you know, he might be crying about. Caparzo is just looking on, trying to figure things out, and then we get a shot of Horvath that you know, he's collecting dirt. You know, he's got these little containers, and he's got a container. You know, he just filled up a container from France, and he has one from Italy, and he has one from Africa, which it says a lot about the journey, just in that little shot.
I love this so much. This is, you know, such a good decision.
Yeah. And
to have Horvath doing this little collection.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, I mean, we talked a little yesterday about Band of Brothers. So I'm a big fan of Band of Brothers, right? And Band of Brothers, we know where they go, where they start, where they end, you know, all that stuff. Here we are given these characters, they start out in a boat. You know, they're in a Higgins boat, and then they get on the beach. And then these are the ones that make it across the beach. And that's it. That's all we really know about their history. You know, you mentioned yesterday, we don't know anything about anything else about their history in the novelization of this movie. So they give minimal information. They tell us everyone's full name and where they're from and how old they are. But again, it's all conjecture anyway.
Also, because I'm very curious, are those ages anywhere near appropriate for actual people who are in D-Day, or are we still celebrating Tom Hanks's 41st birthday here?
No, Tom Miller was 36, I believe, if I remember correctly.
I will accept 36. It's still old for being.
No, he said he was the oldest. He's the oldest man in the platoon. Again,
he's allowed to be older.
He's the captain. So
yes. But everyone, look at literally everyone in this movie and just subtract about 5 years.
pretty much. The one thing that threw me off is that Wade is apparently, according to the book, he's 28, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, no.
I don't accept that one either.
Or maybe they were trying to do some math. If he's okay, he's been through medical school, so he's done that. But that's not how that works. Yeah, no, I will say it again clearly in case any listeners weren't paying attention. Babies fight these wars, guys. Yeah, being a parent has really changed my outlook on a lot of this stuff. But I think. I love Horvath in this. I love his and Miller's connection later when they're talking about, you know, the journey they've been on through all this. And I love seeing his little containers of dirt.
Yeah, again, because it tells us it's great filmmaking, because it's telling us something that within just a fraction of seconds, it's telling us something that we wouldn't know otherwise.
Yeah.
And they don't need to go into to big detail about it and stuff like that. You know, anyone who notices it, and it is very noticeable in this movie, you know, they know that this is a character who is collecting souvenirs from the places they've been, you know. And anyone who knows anything about military history of where the US fought, you know, before they got to Normandy, they were fighting in Italy, and then they were fighting in North Africa. So it just happens to be that Horvath has been in both of those places, or he found someone else's knapsack that had dirt from one of those places and decided to commandeer it
No,
for
because we
himself.
know he was in Italy. They talk about that later.
Right.
So, and that would make sense because a lot of the units did come over from North Africa. I love this. So I had mentioned yesterday that I knew about souvenirs, not souvenirs taken from dead bodies, thank God. The souvenir that I've seen is my grandfather-in-law. I think that's how we would say it. I did not get to meet him. However, I have seen his short snorter role, which, if you don't know, well, so there's a couple different things that a short snorter can be. Short snorter can literally be a dollar bill or a piece of paper currency. And what you would do is you get all your buddies to sign it. Started with bush pilots out in Alaska in the 20s. And so then World War II starts. It became like it was seen as good luck to have everyone in your, you know, sign it before you're going across the Atlantic. So it could just be one thing, one piece of currency. However, what a lot of these guys did and what my grandfather-in-law did was every time you were somewhere new with different currency, you got a piece of the local currency and got everyone to sign it. And then you taped it to the last one and rolled it up in a little roll. And
Oh,
so
wow.
your short roll. And when you are out at drinks, and this is an airman thing, he was in, I'll talk about who he was with in just a second. If you're out at drinks and you cannot produce your short snorter, you're buying. And if everyone can produce their short snorter, there's two ways to break the tie: whoever has the least signatures or whoever has the shortest roll. We unroll. I saw when this roll was passed on to a grandson, it had to be 4 feet long of different, all these
Wow.
different currencies signed by things rolled up. So this was yeah, Dan Morrill, who I found in a book. So, ladies and gentlemen, you have some homework. If you are interested, there is a book called Valor Without Arms: A History of the 316th Troop Carrier Group, 1942 to 1945. It's written by Michael N. Ingrassano Jr. It's wonderful. And if you come across a story about Doc Morrill, that's my grandfather-in-law. And these are the guys that were dropping the these are the guys that were dropping Private Ryan in Normandy, also in Operation Market Garden for the Band of Brothers fans listening. And they had started out in North Africa and then went to Italy and then to France and then to the Netherlands and then to Germany. It's this book is fascinating. Now, it is a it's not like privately published. I mean, it's very impressive. I'm looking at, but it's not like this was a New York Times bestseller, and it is a military history book. It's dry, but it is a beautiful wealth of information. And again, Dan Morrill's in it, so I am biased and love it. That's my connection to Band of Brothers and those guys. But I've also got a connection to Masters of the Air, because y'all might have noticed a little actor. He's done a few things since then. Anthony Boyle. Played this, you know, small role, Crosby, in Masters of the Air. He is based on the grandfather of someone that went to high school with my husband.
Oh, wow.
And her family, when they got to meet him, brought his leather bomber jacket. And there was a picture on Anthony Boyle's Instagram of him trying on the actual jacket and crying of the person that his character was based on. So, yeah, sorry. I'm more airplane oriented than all these men that we're getting to know in this minute.
Okay, but that's fine, because it's all part of the Hanksiverse.
Yes. It's all, you know, D-Day, they're all there. They were up there. I'm all for souvenirs like that. I like souvenirs that are not looted off dead bodies, please and thank you. It's just a little less icky. I think these jars of dirt are a really good idea. And I kind of love that, like, he has, you know.
You think it's a good idea for Horvath, or you think it's a good idea from a, you know, from a filmmaking perspective?
I think it works in both ways. First of all, not only were short snorters a planes thing, so you wouldn't have them in this movie, but also you can't, no one would know what that, unless you know what that is, you don't know what that is. This. They're labeled. We immediately see, okay, this guy went here, then went here, went here. And also on Horvath, I mean, like, yeah, he's technically adding some weight to his pack, but in the grand scheme of things, and it's not like these are huge tins. And then he's going to get to go home and show that, like, that's such a cool thing to have.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he doesn't get to go home, but that's a separate problem.
He doesn't know that.
No, he does not. But again, maybe someone takes it and moves forward with it, you know?
Yeah. So,
Now, again, it's the idea that, okay, this is a guy who has now gone through a battle, and he's gone through numerous battles, and he's saying to himself, okay, I want something to remind me of what I did here.
Mm-hmm. And of where him, I went. We don't know. He might have kids.
Right.
Back home who want to see, you know.
Right. It's very possible. All we know about him is that, you know, he likes to collect dirt. He's like, my son's going to want to make a sandcastle when he gets older. So here, I'm going to bring him some sand.
Literally the minute I said we have kids, I pictured like a toddler mixing them all up. And they're like, oh no.
That's right. Why? Which one was Italy? Which one was Africa?
He invented the sensory box. Good job, Horvath.
That's right. That kid is going to get a nice little beating from his father.
Well, you mentioned the Hanksiverse, and I finally get to be in the Hanksiverse this minute.
Yes, you do. And, you know, again, it's just great the way that they just show. It's a very subtle few seconds. But it speaks volumes for the fact that he's just, you know, sitting there putting this stuff in his pack. And, you know, they basically just give us 3 seconds of it. And then he looks up and, you know, most of this minute is without dialogue, right? So the next thing we see is a hand that's shaking. Now, we've seen this hand shaking before.
Yes.
You know, this is you know, Captain Miller. Captain Miller's hands shaking. We're never quite sure what this trembling is being caused by,
Yeah.
Because
I
when he's it always happens either before battle or right or during battle, you know, but not sorry, before or after battle. It doesn't happen during battle.
Yeah. See,
So
I
it's
saw
some sort of
something online
jitters.
that was saying, yeah, PTSD basically. Like, this is his way of getting it out.
Okay.
So that he's not crying in front of
His men.
his men, you know.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
And what's really interesting is then he takes his left hand and brings his left hand forward, bringing the canteen towards his right hand. Now his left hand is not shaking. It's only his right
Yeah,
hand
no,
that's
it's
shaking.
only his right. And that was the same before. And I kind of like that this movie is completely. He is like, so last minute, Mellish is sobbing in front of everyone else. And no one is like, what the hell is wrong with this guy? Like, they all get it. And but no one says anything. And it's the same thing. You see it a couple times with Miller's hand shaking, where he's just like, yeah, my hand is shaking. What are you going to say about it? You got something to say? No one has anything to say. It is completely unapologetic about everyone has their coping mechanism.
That's right.
That will be respected by everyone else because they get it. Like, everyone's got to have some way of like releasing that, what is it, cortisol or whatever. Now, of course, being the history nerd that I am, I see a right hand shaking in a World War II movie and I'm like, does he have Parkinson's? But
That
that
was the
is
thing that went through
not
my
what is
mind also.
implied. Yes, I think that is our modern brains trying to put something there that is not. I think the PTSD explanation makes so much more sense than, oh, actually, Miller's got this early onset thing.
Yeah, at the age of 36.
Yeah. But then we have a little bit of dialogue
Right. Well,
and
and
then,
also he sh his
oh.
hand shakes. His hand keeps shaking even as he's drinking the water, you know.
Yep.
And then
And
he
he
like
is
takes a
just
big
unfazed
swig.
by it.
That's right. He takes a big swig, and then he just starts staring out into the camera. And once again, Spielberg does a great zoom in on his face, just like they did in, you know, the first few minutes of this movie, where there's the zoom in on the face of the old man. And you know, it made me wonder, is this sort of a fake out here? Are they trying to tell us that right now this is going to be the end of this segment and that we're now going to go back to the old man? You know, for instance, similar to like in Titanic, you know, how throughout the course of the movie it
Oh.
jumps back and forth between
Oh, I didn't
the,
even think of that.
you know, and so that was like when, obviously, I've seen this movie many times and I know that it doesn't do that, but you know,
Yeah.
by doing my research and watching it and seeing how the shot is so similar to that first shot, which again is also a fake out because they want you to believe through most of this movie
That
that
Bud's
it is
Miller.
that it's Miller. Exactly.
Yeah. They got me the
And
first time, I will admit that.
yes, me too. And again, it reaches the point where you know you can see the hairs on his nose and the hairs on his brow. You know, it's a very, very close close-up. You know, we see his eyes. We see just like the, you know, the wonderment in his eyes as to what he's going to do now. And then the shot changes, and then we see more or less what he's looking at. And we
No,
see.
before that happens. This is my Steven Spielberg is very good at what he does. There is the little bit of dialogue of this minute.
Right.
Someone
Okay.
says
You're
to
right.
Miller,
Yes. Horvath says to Miller, "That's quite a view." And then he
that's
responds,
quite a
"Yes,
view.
it
And
is."
instead of cutting to the beaches and we see it later in the movie, they have the technology to show the ducks coming ashore and everything. But instead of a sweeping vista of the landing beaches, what's quite a view? That's quite a view is close up on the bodies.
That's right. He goes, "Yes, it is quite a view."
Oh
And
my
then,
God, it's so good.
that's right. It really is.
It's so dark. Steven Spielberg is so good at this. Oh my God.
And I mean, even and they even get the waves crashing in, and the water
Oh.
is slightly colored so that
It's
you know
pushing the
there's
bodies back and forth with the weight. Oh my God.
yes.
It's so dark. I love it. Oh man.
Can you imagine being one of these actors and being told, okay, just lie there in the water as the, let the water take you, move back and forth. It's yes, you're right. It is very dark. But and I love the way that it's not only the bodies, there's also equipment. There's a box of TNT fragments. The grenades and there's ammunition. I don't even know what you would call it. Boxes that hold ammunition and stuff like that. Like this is all just like stuff that has is washing up on the shore. You have the Mae West. There's a Mae West of apparently one of the guys that's just floating on the water there also. The Mae West is the flotation device,
Life,
if you're wondering. Right, the small little life preserver that we saw a few weeks ago. Again, it's just done so well,
it's
and creepy in some
yeah.
ways.
It's so because when you're in a D-Day movie and someone says that's quite a view, you expect them to cut to the like that view. We've all seen that view of D-Day of the beaches afterwards. Like
That's right.
they did it. They're up at the top of the beach. Now they look back, but no, we are going straight for the jugular in this movie.
Correct.
And we are going to get right back into the cost of what just happened?
That's right. Now, I'm going to ask you a question now that you probably don't know the answer to. Do you know how many Allied casualties there were on the beaches on D-Day, and specifically how many there were on Omaha Beach.
Oh, I
And
don't
we're talking
remember.
casualties I'm referring to, killed, wounded, or missing. Could be
Yeah.
all of the above.
I do not know.
So Omaha Beach was one of the bloodiest. There was between 5,000 and 6,000 men that were killed, wounded, or missing. Overall, the overall estimate for all of the Allied casualties on the storming of the beaches was 10,000, which means that Omaha Beach was approximately half of everyone. They claimed that 2,500 were killed. But then they did some more research, and the National D-Day Memorial confirmed that there were 4,414 deaths. Just by storming the beaches, 2,499 of them were Americans, and 1,915 were from other nations. But again, 2,500 deaths, that's just amazing. The just thinking of the
In
sheer
this.
numbers, just from storming these beaches. I mean, again, there's more than just Omaha, but I mean, as we've seen over the last 5 weeks of going through this, Omaha Beach, was quite bloody. There was the way that these casualties happened. I mean, this movie really gives us an intimate view as to how and what happened there, and scary from that perspective. So that's all I have for this minute. Did you have anything else you wanted to mention for this about this minute?
Nope, we're good.
All right, so let's move on to today's segment. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Tom Hanks Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five Tom Hanks performances. Now I know you're a little bit of a fan of Tom Hanks, so this one was probably not easy for you either.
It was not easy, and one of the things that really gets me is my five placement because I know that Tom Hanks himself hates this performance and like has been very honest in interviews about it being one of his worst, but I do not care. I'm giving the five spot to Joe versus the Volcano. I love that movie. I love that movie so much. It's one of my favorites. I did an entire Movies by Minute podcast on it. Sorry that you don't enjoy it, Tom. Number five is going to Joe versus Volcano. Number four, I chose Sleepless in Seattle, one of his best rom-coms. Now, I would like to point out Joe versus Volcano was the first Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks rom-com pairing,
Yes.
but Sleepless in Seattle is is such a classic, and it's a perfect example of like Tom Hanks is not a sexy man, and yet every woman in Sleepless in Seattle falls in love with him to some extent, and it makes and she leaves Bill Pullman, for God's sake, my one of my biggest 90s crushes.
Well, he's got all these allergies.
But it makes that, like, the way that Tom Hanks plays that role is just so well done. And I quote it all the time. It's like, "Hello, Diane. Have a look at these swatches." Number three, I did A League of Their Own.
What a
just
surprise.
Because it's what a surprise. He does Jimmy Dugan perfectly. Jimmy Dugan has more to, like, you could play that just as a total buffoon. You could play that as wanting to be a romantic lead in a movie that does not have a romantic story. And again, he toes that line very well. Two, I did Philadelphia. Got to give him some of his serious acting credits. And I mean, he's just so good at that. Number one, I bet is going to be controversial. I chose Big.
I knew that's where you were going for some reason. Based on the way that you just said that, I knew that you were going towards Big.
And it's one of those things, like, I would not be surprised if Big is on a lot of people's top five lists, but I feel like it wouldn't normally be the top one. But it just, I don't know, it just so captures that perfect, like, you know, he's playing, it could be played very buffoony.
Okay, well, of the six people who have already done this list, there are three of them, including you, have put Big on their top five. You were the only one who has it at number five. Someone else had it at four, and someone else had it at three.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I was doing it in reverse, so I went.
No,
five
I understand.
To one, but
no,
yeah,
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. No, I was talking about point wise. Sorry. That,
oh, okay.
You know,
yeah.
First place gets 5 points. That type of thing. I apologize. So first place, second place, and third place. How's that? Is that better?
Oh, I love it. But yeah, it's just that movie. It makes me cry. And it's so good. Like, he's playing a child and adult, but like, that is not an easy role. So yeah, that's my top five Tom Hanks performances.
All right. Excellent. So Tierney, would you
I guess honorary shout out to Forrest Gump, only because, like, I mean, he carries that. That movie doesn't work if Tom Hanks doesn't work in it, but I don't know. These others are so much better. They're just better movies.
Okay, that's fair. That's definitely fair. All right, so would you like to once again tell people where they can find Tierney?
Yes, Tierney. My last name, well, my maiden last name is Steele, Steele. So if you go to onesteelsister.com, you will find all the podcasts I've done, including podcasts on A League of Their Own and on Joe versus the Volcano, which is why he was laughing at me, but I put it on there. And it has links to my guest appearances, and it also has a link to the book that I wrote, which has nothing to do with World War II or any of that, but it has Spielberg-obsessed characters in it. So there you go.
Always good to have Spielberg-obsessed characters.
Always.
Yeah. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@movearound.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this.
Gone by.